Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. So I think there was a request earlier to start looking at what the Buddha said, and to take a certain themes, and we can discuss the certain themes every week. So that's not what we're doing tonight. But I thought it'd be good to for the next few weeks anyway, try to address the certain themes that I will research and start with that anyway. And the theme I was thinking would be good for, you know, as a whole community to go through was the kind of the Eightfold Path, you know, and how the Buddha defined each of the factor of the Eightfold Path. But tonight I was just saying kind of focus on kind of overall view and the structure and how the Buddha approached, you know, talking the Eightfold Path. Eightfold Path, obviously, is the first teaching that the Buddha gave after he became enlightened. Eightfold Path is, you know, another word for it. It's called the middle way, the way avoiding two extremes of sensual desires and ascetic practices and self-torture. Not middle in the way that, you know, some people think, oh, well, monks, you know, eating one meal a day is a bit drastic. Celibacy, a bit drastic. Why don't you guys just lose enough? You know, have a meal, have a dinner or something. Have a partner. Have some kids. That's more of a middle way. Not quite. The middle way, in the Buddhist perspective, is, like I said, it's the middle way between, you know, greed and anger. So it's not like from left and right, but it's like kind of up there somewhere. Yeah, so it's altogether outside. But it is. It's a path of towards wisdom. It's a path out of this world. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's more of, so it's not really, you know, about... and it's the way of, you know, always balancing, you know, the path that is the even path, the way you can look at it. The path that's not, you know, not too many ups and downs, kind of emotional roller coaster that a lot of people get into. It's an even path of wisdom, path of letting go, path of acceptance. And the Buddha said, you know, there was an ascetic that asked, you know, outside of the Buddha's teaching, outside of Buddhism, outside the Buddha dispensation, are there enlightened beings? And he gave a very good answer. He didn't say yes or no. It was, you know, some religion you were expecting to say, no, of course not. Outside of Buddhism or outside of whatever, there's, you know, we're the only way. No, that's not how he said it. He answered the question in this way. He says, whatever path there is, whatever path or practice people do, regardless what their belief system is, their religion, religious affiliation, whatever path that the practice of people undertaken that has the Eightfold Path, then there'll be enlightened beings. Then there'll be, you know, stream enterer. Then there'll be you know, full enlightenment, full awakening. There'll be, you know, full release from suffering. And the Eightfold Path is, as some of you may know, can be summarized into the threefold path of sila, obviously of harmlessness, virtue, of samadhi, stillness, concentration, and wisdom. But it's the term, the four, kind of the full technical Eightfold Path starts out with right view, samaditti, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, right? And those leads to, like you say, full release from suffering. Any path that has those components in there, then there's the path that's the middle way. It's the way that leads away from sensual indulgence and greed, where it leads also away from anger, irritation. I wanted, you know, like this morning was reading, there's only really two main things a lot of time it plays in our mind, wanting something or wanting to get rid of something. That's what most of us deal with. Now, of course, behind all that is delusion, not seeing clearly. That's where the craving comes up. But it's true. You see, you know, you have a little bit of mindfulness. You watch the mind, you see. You know, I like this person. Once more time. I like this. I want more of this. Oh, I don't like that. I want to get rid of it. I want to move away from it. I want to change something else. That's why it dies all day long. Awaken moment. More of this, less of this. More of this, less of this. And it's not peaceful because you're swinging back and forth all the time. So the middle way is a path of evenness, path of, you know, equanimous, path of clarity and wisdom. Right? And but there are different kind of factors and conditions that starts, you know, that helps us to kind of develop the Eightfold Path. One of the famous teaching the Buddha said was Ananda asked him, you know, what is the holy life, or what is good friendship? You know, how does good companionship, Kalyana Mitta, you know, is that half the holy life? And the Buddha said, no, the good companionship is the full of the holy life, I mean, associating with good people. You would think, well, you know, don't you have to do some work yourself? Don't you have to, you know, kind of do your own meditation, look after your own virtue, develop your own wisdom? How can just hanging out with good people be the whole thing of the practice, be the whole spiritual life? But the Buddha said, because if you hang out or associate with good people, it helps you to develop the Eightfold Path. And that's why good companionship is such a great kind of condition to allow you to form. And as you see, you know, you look into the world, and so much of the world is, you know, pulling you in the opposite direction, and not developing calm, not developing clarity, not developing simplicity. It pulls in the opposite direction. So that's why associating, having good friends, having friends that are, you know, into the practice, having friends that are kind of encourage and lead you to peace and clarity is so important, because then it sets up the whole framework of the spiritual life. And if you associate with the wrong people, then that tends to kind of pull you away from the Eightfold Path. And that's why the Buddha said, you know, good companionship is so important. But also a good sense of kind of this Buddhist term of hiri-otapa, a sense of, you know, a healthy sense of fear of wrongdoing. Knowing, you know, understand the law of karma. If you do anything out of greed, anger, irritation, those things come back to haunt you. Those things will result in suffering now and in the future. So it's not the usual, the guilt of the Christian sense that you're gonna, you know, you do, you know, you're gonna go to hell, or you're gonna be punished, or you're gonna be forever irredeemable. No, it's this kind of rational awareness of fear of, yeah, if you, you know, you do something unwholesome, those will result in future suffering for yourself and others. And so therefore, knowing, wanting to be happy, wanting to be, you know, looking after your own welfare and other people's welfare, you want to, you know, do wholesome karma. That would be a basis for your own welfare and happiness and the happiness of the people around you. So that's the reason why you avoid any unskillful action. Not because you're a Buddhist and you have to, you know, love everybody and only do good things all the time. No, no, because you understand the law of karma. And you understand that, yeah, doing wholesome karma, being kind and gentle, practicing meditation, brings a sense of well-being. Brings a sense of clarity, a sense of purpose to your life. And that has its own reward. It's not because you want to get to heaven, it's not because you want to be a good Buddhist, but you understand, yeah, living a simple life, living a calm life, living, you know, being careful, being thoughtful of others, trying to, you know, being kind to others, brings a sense of happiness, a sense of well-being, brings a sense of confidence to ourselves. That, you know, yeah, we can be a force of goodness in the world. We can spread peace and kindness out, little by little, not some grand scheme, some grand project, but, you know, moment by moment, day by day, person by person, anyone we come into contact with, we just take that extra effort to focus on, to be as careful, gentle as we can, but also fully accepting that we make mistakes. We can be impatient. We can be in a hurry. We can be not so mindful at times. We can be a bit of self-obsessed with our own desires and our own agendas. Sure, that happens from time to time. We all make mistakes, but that's okay. Part of the path is just kind of renewing this intention. And that's why right intention is so important. So I'll just say something, I'll backtrack first, say something about right view. There are many also different levels of right view and how deeply it penetrates into your own mind, your own personality. And the traditional, you know, the right view of the Buddha talks over and over again is obviously the view of there's a law of karma. That, you know, you do good things, those come back to you. Law of karma is like a law of gravity. It applies equally to all beings, not just human beings, animal realm, any the different realms in this world. And it's an eternal law. It affects everybody. No one can alleviate or can escape from that law. No one can help each other. Buddha can't come down and say, oh, no, you know, I negate your bad karma for you. You don't have to worry about it. And so even the Buddha can't do that. All the arahants can't do that. And I'll say that, yeah, if I can practice for you, I would. Out of compassion, I would do all the work and make your path really easy. But I can't. You hear that? You know, even the Buddha said, you know, all he can do, he shows the way. And each and every one of us have to pursue our own path, have to make our own good karma. Right? So that's the beginning. The law of karma is like gravity. Applies to everybody and everything. Whether people, when you are naughty, you don't think you'll get caught, do things in the dark, it still applies, unfortunately. It's like water. What goes up, flows in a certain direction. A lot of gravity. What goes up, always go down. So we do good things, we can be sure our faith increases, or you at least have faith in the beginning. You know that those good results will come in the future sometime. And likewise, the opposite is also true. And sometimes you don't see it. You say, well, yeah, you always say that, but I see lots of wealthy, smart, successful people, and they don't look very nice. They do all sorts of dodgy things. They cheat on their taxes. They're mean to their employees. And they seem to be enjoying the good success. Donald Trump runs around all the time, and he's really a mean guy. Well, why is he successful? It's not fair. Maybe the law of karma doesn't apply. For one, it's not true. You don't know what he's meant to say. You look closely, you might think, well, you know, he might have the external trappings of success, you know, lots of wealth and a big bank account, and he owns lots of things. But you don't know now how happy he truly is, how peaceful it is, and what his personal life is like. Right? And you know, you'll see, you know, so once you get to know people and you see clearly that, yeah, you know, externally they may look like they have lots of things going for them, but look closely, you know, there's a lot of internal struggles, a lot of fears, anxieties, wanting to be staying on top, not wanting to lose his wealth, and not and worrying with people, you know, who wants to take advantage of him. Yeah, so there's a lot of things that you, as we may not see so, you know, when you don't know the person, when we project that, you know, they seem to be happy, but could be farther from the case. And that was going back to the, you know, kind of the right view. Yeah, the right view is there are other worlds. You know, this is not the only life that we have, that we do, you know, when we pass away from this existence on earth. You know, there are other dimensions, there are other lives, you know, that we go to. And those are regulated by, you know, the karma that we make in this life. And if you and it at least you know, you might say, well, you know, according to scientific you know, kind of research, so far we haven't discovered, there's no cameras that takes pictures of the other life. If there are ghosts and heavenly angels, why can't the cameras capture these things? And all sorts of things. Well, you know, that's not very scientific, Ajahn. You know, we're talking about the different realms and different worlds and the ghosts and the heavenly beings, and that sounds a bit kind of airy fairy. Kind of like those kind of science fictions or cartoons or whatever that you read. And, but, you know, yeah, so it's hard to convince people, obviously, if you don't have belief. But at least if you're practicing, And this kind of open-mindedness that says, there may be things that we haven't fully discovered. There may be things that science hasn't really kind of, you know, seems to be able to measure, to understand. But at least, you know, you're open to that, yeah, you know, this body, this life, it's not the only thing. That when you do, when you pass away, there's a continuum of consciousness. And there's a mind that's not in the material world, but something outside of that. And as you meditate, so mind become more calm, you can get a sense of this, that there is something beyond the material world. You know, and you at least, or you have faith in the different meditation teachers, they talk about their different experiences, you know, when the mind's very peaceful, the body can be there and they can move in, you know, they can leave the body and they still have a sense. Or you can read different scientific kind of research and, you know, near-death experiences when, you know, the people lying on the operating table, more and more research is coming now, the brain wave is dead, heart is not pumping. But there's some of them can still be aware what's happening. Yeah, so there's more and more research into that. Yeah, there is not the non-material world. So this is kind of opening up, you know, our consciousness to understand. And then when you understand that there is the other world, then sometimes that's why people in the world get caught into sensuality. And there's only one life. Yeah, of course, you want to grab as much happiness as you can. You don't care about anything else as much as you can. Then you die, that's the end of that. So why do I have to worry? Why do I have to worry about the bad karma I'm making? Who I cheated and hurt and abused? Can we die? We're all even. But you understand that, yeah, no, this is not the only life. So you have more of a long-term view. You know, you have to kind of get everything this lifetime. You understand that it's a continuum. That, you know, and sometimes the practice, yeah, we all have the potential, certainly, to become enlightened this lifetime. But also that understanding that it is the gradual path, the eightfold path, gradual path of, you know, wholesome karma, developing the mind, cultivating wisdom, or conditions for wisdom to arise. And it could take many, many lifetimes. But that doesn't matter. Remember how we chant in the morning all the time. The Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. So at each stage of the practice, there's an increasing sense of well-being, the increasing sense of clarity, increasing sense of, you know, happiness, of joy. You know, my short time as a monk, being in a monastery for the last 16 years, yeah. You know, the fact that you get to meet, for myself and me, really beautiful monks, beautiful monastics, great monks that come from Thailand to come over. You know, the fact that you just pay respect to them, that's worth it. At least, you know, 16, 20 years of being a monk. Just being a monk allowed to, you know, be able to pay respect to Ajahn Thun, Lupa Lim, that's wonderful. And that's the only thing I get out of my monastic life. That's more than enough. But a lot of times you get so much more. You know, meeting so many people, and coming to the monastery, you know, kind, gentle people are sometimes confused, distracted in the monastery. But then after a couple of weeks, after a couple of days, they become more calm, more bright, more happier. So you see the change the Dhamma has, the effect on other people. So that brings a sense of a lot of happiness, brings a sense of confidence that, you know, the Dhamma that the Buddha discovered is something precious and is something that is powerful, something that yields result. It's not just a theory, it's not just an idea, but it's something that, you know, is concrete, it's tangible, that there are benefits but that people gain from. And certainly in my own practice, you can see it's a beautiful thing. And so there's no need to rush to the end, to be, you know, to finish the work, to become enlightened. And next year, tomorrow, next week, or even this lifetime. Because the path is a path of beauty, path of gentleness, path of clarity. So there's no need to rush towards the end. And the more you understand the path, the more you relax, you take it easy, you'll see that, you know, these path factors come together. We're talking the Eightfold Path. Sometimes you say, you know, people, because we enumerate, you started with right view, then you go to right intention, right speech, right action. If you feel like you have to develop one after the other or something. No, it's they're like eight spokes on a wheel. You need all of them. There's not a sevenfold path or a sixfold path. You just can't skip sila. Can't go straight to wisdom. You can't skip, you know, this bit to, you know, the livelihood you don't like. Not so exciting. It's they all come together and they support each other. Right? So one is missing, the wheel won't go straight. It's going to be kind of a rocky journey. Yeah, so they come together in different ways and they strengthen each other and become deeper and deeper, strong or stronger and stronger, or faster and faster, whatever, however you see, you know, you see the simile of the wheel rolling on, kind of the unfolding of the Dhamma. Yeah, because when you see clearly, then you understand, then there's not a faith in the law of karma, you see how the law of karma come into play. So after a while, it's not faith anymore, it's kind of knowledge. But it also starts out with faith, you know. Because you don't know for sure how the law of karma unfolds. You just have this general, you know, belief, general idea that, yeah, you know, the Buddha says, you know, you do good karma, it goes to be resolved, but you don't know for sure. Now, sometimes your experience in life may not validate that just yet. And you think, I don't know about this. But I think, you know, the more you practice, the deeper the insight is, you see clearly what the Buddha said about, you know, impermanence, not self, suffering of this world. But you see clearly into, you know, the, you know, whatever, the terms of the law of karma. And you can have good meditation and see the different sense realm, the ghost realm, or whatever that you experience through deep meditation. Then yeah, your view are strengthened. Then when you see that, your intentions also strengthen. Right? So right view, believe in the law of karma, believe in that there's a different world, believe in that there are enlightened beings, that the Buddha was truly enlightened, he wasn't guessing, he wasn't kind of making things up. They did see clearly, and he can teach really well. So those are all part of right view. And when you have right view, you start to kind of move towards the right intention. Right intention, intention of renunciation, not getting caught up into the pleasure of the sense world. Right intention is the intention towards loving kindness, gentleness, embracing, and intention of non-cruelty, moving away from, you know, harming or hurting others. And that, you know, like I said, as you practice, you become more sensitive, and you can see clearly, or you can feel it, you know, how much suffering there is to have ill will in the mind, to hold a grudge, to think of, you know, kind, you know, to think of kind of mean thoughts about others, or to fall fine. It's not a very happy existence. We all do it from bad habits from time to time. But then you see clear, like, oh, it's not very nice to think about these, you know, criticize people about this way. Oh, so-and-so is pretty sloppy. So-and-so never wash after themselves. So-and-so makes them, you know, doesn't do a good job when they clean the toilet, they leave things behind. Well, that goes wrong, and this goes wrong. You're like, after all, you're like, oh, it's not very nice. Why don't I just kind of switch, you know, views in a positive way? You know, at least they cleaned the toilet. They didn't do a great job, but at least, you know, they gave it a go. You know? Or so-and-so, at least they're in the monastery, trying to practice. At least the intention is in the right place. They see the heart is in the right place. They may not be perfect, but, you know, they're trying. And that is very noble, at least. It's the intention to improve themselves, the intention to keep the rules. Okay, maybe they sneak into the kitchen and eat, you know, a couple of times a week, but that's okay. They're keeping 5 days out of 7 days. That's not too bad. Or 2 days. 2 days out of 6 months or somewhere, whatever. You know, just trying to see, because, you know, we're so used in the modern world of looking what's wrong with the world. And really, if you're in Australia at the moment, you're here. There are so many things going right for you that, you know, that you have very little to compare to the rest of the world, you know, compare to the people in Syria, compare to the war-torn country, compare to the homeless, compare to the people in the hospital. I know sometimes we're in a bad mood, we don't say, yeah, I don't care about that, I'm still in a bad mood. Fair enough. But from time to time, it's good to kind of bring these reflections into mind that, you know, yeah, okay, our health may not be perfect, we're not so young anymore, but it's still good enough. We can still practice. Yes, you didn't get your right perfect job, your dream job. You didn't get your dream partner that you wanted. But you know, it's good enough. You can still practice, you can still meditate, you can still make good karma, you can still, you know, you have a roof over your head, you have plenty of food. So things are great, really. They're not more than good enough, they're great. Because we have this opportunity to come into contact with the Dhamma. We have this opportunity, really, to practice, to learn from experience, to learn from life. So many people in the world that, you know, don't even, not aware of, you know, the training of the mind, are not aware of, you know, that this, you know, the benefits of living a simple moral life, the sense of well-being that comes from it. So much of the world just knows, you know, happiness through eating, watching, getting, having, getting your way. And those happiness are so kind of shallow. They're so fleeting. That's why you see more and more people getting just to kind of a mental disease, because they're chasing after a shadow, chasing after something that's not fulfilling. So of course they feel empty. Like, why am I feeling empty? Well, of course you're chasing achievement, you're chasing, you know, stability in a very unstable world. So of course there's a sense of anxiety, of course there's a sense of emptiness, because you're looking after the wrong things. You're not looking inward, you're not cultivating this kind of peace, stillness of the mind, clarity of the mind. So the more we kind of, you know, chase after thinking happiness is out there somewhere, there's something you buy or something you save up to, something you wait for. When you retire, you're not working anymore, that's when you become happy. Or whatever, when the kid's growing up, then I'll become happy. Or when you get the right job, then be happy. Or you have the right partner, then you'll be happy. And we keep chasing after this. And of course, it never quite get there. There's like, oh yeah, of course, it brings a little bit of happiness, you know, going on your holiday, buying something new. I mean, a little happiness, but then it evaporates, and you gotta go do more of that, chase after that more. So after a while, because we get into the sense world, we get caught into the sensual pool. After a while, we get very tired, just running, chasing after around, and then this kind of dissatisfaction, because this emptiness of sense pleasure disappears very quickly, and then we're left with nothing, and then we get annoyed, we get confused. Right, so that's why the Buddha recommends, yeah, there is happiness and sense pleasure, but not very much. And just to be aware of that. Not to say, okay, you know, I shouldn't have my cake, I should never eat cake anymore, I should never have a hot shower, sense pleasure is bad, I should take cold showers only, or whatever, try to be too ascetic. No, it's just understanding, yeah, there's happiness, but it's not very long. Not very steady, not very dependable. Even in economics, they even talk about that. The ideas of diminishing returns, that your first burger is really great, but then you buy another second burger, nah, it's not as good as the first burger, obviously. And your third burger, yeah, it's okay. Fourth burger, no, I can't look at another burger, right? So whatever it is, what do you have? It's really good, but after that, it goes down. It's the same. You ask the millionaire, you know, I'm sure Trump, his first million is wonderful. Yes, that's right. Second million, yeah, it's okay. Doesn't bring as much happiness. His 10th million, he's probably not even thinking about it. Yeah, because his sense pleasure is like, it's just the more you have, it's not, you think, the more you have, the happier you become. That's not how it works. It trails up very quickly. Yeah. So that's why the sense pleasure is such an unstable thing. That's what the Buddha says, you know, to move away from that. But through clarity, through wisdom, not through, you know, willpower, not through fear, not through some idea that's what you should be doing. Yes, the right intention is intention of renouncing, intention of kindness, gentleness, and kind of non-cruelty. You know, try as much as you can not to inflict suffering to others. And like I said, this Eightfold Path is just moving from one factor to the next. Starts out with the mind, and it goes to speech, action, which I'll go to more details in the next few weeks. Livelihood, you know, what we spend our time doing, that has an effect on the mind. And right effort. And yeah, there's energy involved. But it's not kind of this external energy of restlessness, or energy comes from a sense of self, of ego, of wanting to be enlightened, wanting to be this or that, wanting to achieve something, but this energy into clarity, into what am I, what is it that I'm doing? Where am I? And is my mind wholesome or not? So this energy into developing wholesome states of mind, or diminishing unwholesome state of mind. That's the energy, that's the effort to put into that. And that effort only comes around when you have mindfulness. So mindfulness is always being aware, you know, watching over the mind. Where's my mind? What am I doing? What am I thinking? Is that wholesome? Is that going to lead to my welfare and happiness or not? That's why when you have this, when you're more sensitive, you can see what the mind is. You can see, all the suffering that we create for ourselves and others. So much of this is just in the mind. And a lot of times it's because we're not clear on what the mind is doing. And then when we get caught up into bad habits, then we see clearly what the mind is, then we can slowly change to kind of rewire how we look at the world. If it's unskillful, how we look at others, when we try to kind of move towards more of a wholesome way of kindness and gentleness, acceptance, embracing, or at least moving away from sense of cruelty or vengefulness, grudging, grudge holding, fault finding. And then with all this kind of, moving away from unwholesome, moving towards wholesome, then there's a stillness that brings to the mind, peacefulness, a simplicity. And that's why then you find that the minds become more calm when you meditate. And it becomes more steady. And with a steady mind, you see more clearly. Yeah, so the path, like I said, the path factor starts to be strengthened. You see the benefits of, keeping the harmlessness. You see the benefits of having right speech. You see the benefits of having good livelihood. Not, trading alcohol, not harming other people, not doing things, and trading poison, or anything that will hurt other beings. Because you see into your own mind. We all want happiness. We want self-being. And knowing that, we all kind of, what suffering feels like in the mind. When the mind is anxious, you know what it feels like when you don't get what you want. You know what it feels like when you get criticized, when you feel sad or lonely. So knowing all those kind of negative states of mind, what suffering feels like, you understand that, you don't want to inflict those negativity on others. Someone says, have you ever been homeless once? Then you would never walk by a homeless person without doing something to help them. You should understand the feeling of loneliness, the feeling of not being there. Yeah, it's the same. So, when we all, understand suffering to a certain extent, we've all been there, feeling, loneliness, feeling of anxiety, feeling sad, or whatever. So then, when we understand, we're more sensitive to that, then we try in any ways that we can, obviously, to lessen the suffering in others when you see them. Doing a way that, obviously, trying to lessen it, but also being equanimous, using wisdom, knowing that the world, sometimes the world is full of suffering. We do what we can, but we can never fully eliminate the suffering in the world. But when this opportunity arises, you do what you can, certainly. Anybody comes to you and help, you try to help. But also, like you said, it's a two-way street. You also learn to look after yourself, knowing that unless you're happy, it's hard to have that happiness, to share that happiness, unless you yourself are steady, you yourself a sense of well-being. You can't give or share what you don't have. Yeah, so that's where learning to look after our mind is so important. Learning to, and also understand, what makes you happy? What makes you more peaceful? Yeah, so like I said, the overall structure of the Eightfold Path, it's not a kind of, it's not really a gradual path where your right view goes into right intention and right speech, but it's different aspects of the path. And that helps to nurture each other, helps to strengthen each other, deepen. Yeah. And it, like I said, it is a path of happiness. a path of lessening suffering, path of clarity. The Buddha said, you know, it's a path of practice that leads to the end of, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. It's a path that leads to nirvana. A lot of times it starts with, you know, right friendship, starts with having an idea of a rational sense of feeling, you know, remorse or guilt about, you know, any bad action that we could take. And we do that, and yeah. So it starts with, you know, being in the right place, having people around you. And with that, we have confidence and faith to develop. We help each other, nurture each other, develop, going towards the same direction, towards nirvana, towards letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion. Then when we develop this Eightfold Path, it's not just for yourself, it's for others around you as well. So that's why it's a path of, you know, welfare of, you know, for the many. Like the Buddha said, the Buddha became enlightened, the Dhamma is practiced for the welfare of the many. And then this generation, but also next generation. So when we do our own practice, we're also practicing for the welfare and happiness of all beings as well. Yeah, so that's the Buddha's path and the Eightfold Path. Starting from right view, right intention, right speech, right action, which I will go through hopefully in the next few weeks, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness, right concentration. So maybe hopefully next year. So I leave that for you for to contemplate tonight. I leave that for you just to kind of to bring that into practice, to reflect on the Eightfold Path, and just not for our own practice, but for, you know, the welfare and happiness of all beings that we come into contact with. Can I leave that for now?
Andamayam ovada dhamma kataya sadhu karam dadamase sadhu sadhu.